In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Hey, hey. It's time to talk movies. Pass the Popcorn. Alan Adams of The Main Edge right here with us in studio. Coming off a fine weekend. I couldn't remember what the weather was like at first today, but I think it was good, right?
Yeah, no, we had a pretty good one.
Yeah.
Saturday night was a little wet, but other than that, like, it was nice. It was nice to get out and about. Went down east, visited with the in-laws, did some stuff. It was nice.
Got to see family. That's always good.
Always a good thing, for sure.
Excellent, excellent. And I got to see Stella from afar yesterday.
That's right, and it's so funny because we never go that way. It was really a wonderful little coincidence that our paths happened to sort of cross at that sort of moment. So
I hope I didn't embarrass her.
Oh no, she's
like, Stella's pooping.
She actually appreciates the enthusiasm.
Like, oh, good, it's, good.
Yeah, she enjoys being cheered on when she's, because everything she does is very, very important.
Right. See, Ginger gets she's very coy about taking care of business. She does not want eye contact.
Sure, I get that too.
Yep. And then, of course, buries her shame by digging and digging afterwards.
I know that my loved ones get very angry at me when I make eye contact with them while they're trying to poop. So I get it.
Right. I understand. Who wants that? You know, that's a special breed indeed. Did you watch any of the Emmys? Do you care about the Emmys?
I'm always a little interested. Like, I checked in and sort of enjoyed it, bits and pieces in between sort of football watching and whatnot. I was listening to you guys on the way in here, and you're right. Like, it's not like there were any big shockers in there as far as like who won. The one thing that I feel like I learned this today, I want to say it's The Handmaid's Tale. Set a record for most Emmy losses of any show ever.
Really? In one year or all time?
I think just all time, just because it's the show that always gets a slew of nominations, right, and then never wins anything.
Yeah.
But Ted Lasso. I love me some Ted Lasso.
Oh, so good.
I appreciate, I think the people who won for that show deserve to win, although you really could have picked any number of, it's such a top-notch ensemble. Yeah. I will say, seeing the first image of Brendan Hunt in the crowd dressed like the Penguin. Like, I think he was dressed like the Penguin. Like, it was just like, top hat and tails. I'm like, I feel like I could hang with that guy. I feel like he's someone that I would very much enjoy partying with.
Do you follow him on Twitter?
I don't.
He is a very interesting and fun follow on Twitter.
I can only imagine.
And we'll interact with people.
Sure.
But in a very Coach Beard kind of way.
Excellent. That's what you like to hear.
Yeah. Good stuff.
But yes.
The best part of the whole night was Conan.
Yes. Oh, like, well, and it's funny because, only Conan O'Brien could manage to win the Emmys without winning an Emmy.
Right.
But yeah, just a remarkable bit of just in the moment comedy. Even John Oliver, whose show actually did win the award that Conan was up for, was like, this is kind of ridiculous. Yeah. Everyone who matters knows how important Conan is to comedy history, to television history, you name it. So it was nice to see that sort of bit play out in real time.
Now, I wanted to ask you, because we talked about it last week. Did you watch any of the Jeopardy episodes last week?
I didn't. Like, I just, it just felt gross. I didn't want to.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I just didn't want to. And knowing that it was just five and out, like, it's like, oh, I could skip a week. That's
right.
Not a big deal. And it turns out it wasn't a big deal, because the dude who was the champion's still the champion.
Matt Imodio rolling on. He's great.
Love that guy. Yeah. Love that guy.
So who's hosting tonight?
It's Mayim Bialik.
Okay.
And I believe her episodes run through beginning of November. And then she and Ken Jennings are going to be sort of tag teaming for the rest of the season.
Now, will they be on the same show together? How's that work?
I think it's going to be like alternating tape weeks, because they only tape 2 days a week.
Right.
So it'd be 2 weeks at a time. Because they tape five episodes in a day, so it'd be like, that's what I assume. I don't know, but But yeah, that would be my guess.
All right. That makes sense. All right, let's talk movies. What did you get to see?
I saw three this week. I saw a Netflix sort of kid-oriented horror flick called Nightbooks. I saw on HBO Max, I saw Clint Eastwood's latest Crime Macho.
Oh, yeah.
And I went to the movies to see the movie Cop Shop, starring Gerard Butler and Frank Grillo. And, you know, when I go to the theater, I wear a mask, I did not wear a mask while watching Cop Shop. Do you want to know why, Rich?
Yes.
Because I was the only person in the theater.
Oh, wow. So this is going to be a smash.
It was one of those things where it's like, you know, when it really dawned on me, like, you know, the previews are rolling and I'm like, oh man, I'm the only person here.
Alan Adams, private screening.
Right. And it was just, and, you know, I'm not going to, you know, we have a number of theaters in the area. I'm not going to name any names because, you know, you don't want anyone to think that, you know, that business is bad or whatever. But I will say it was a very comfortable experience. I really, frankly, enjoyed the movie a lot more than I was going to. But we'll get to that.
All right. What do you want to start with then?
Let's do Nightbooks first, just because this was like I saw this almost on a whim. It dropped on last Wednesday on Netflix. It's directed by David Yurofsky. Who's best known, I think, he's only directed a couple of movies. His best known one is probably the movie Brightburn from 2019,
okay.
Where the sort of you know, evil Superman origin story kind of movie, which I think it's underrated. I actually quite liked it, but that's neither here nor there. And so this one, it's interesting, Rich, because I you know, I came of age in the 1980s, and the reality is, kid movies, particularly kid movies with that sort of horror, scary element, were very different in the 80s than they were now. Mostly because I think everyone was still trying to work out the whole distinction between G, PG, PG-13, like ratings, and the sorts of things that were considered not only acceptable but welcome for children to watch, a little different. I gotta say, and I mean, I have a fondness for those movies. I still love kids movies. Like, you know, I always have an affinity for them. This one feels like a little bit of a throwback to those earlier times. It is
so nice.
It's pretty scary. It's reasonably well made. The kid actors are solid, and everyone seems to be having a really good time. But so the basic gist is, you have this little kid, probably 10 years old. His name's Alex Mosher. Played by Winslow Fegley. He's living in Brooklyn with his parents. He's one of those kids who's sort of obsessed with sort of the macabre, like spooky stuff, horror stuff. You know, as often happens with kids who are into that sort of thing, his peers don't necessarily understand. And so he's a bit of an outcast because of it. And, one night, the night of his birthday party, his sort of spooky themed birthday party, nobody comes. And so the kid is, you know, he's heartbroken. And so he's like, you know what? I'm done with all this stuff. And he picks up his notebook. So because he writes these scary stories, these notebooks, he calls them his nightbooks. And he's like, I'm going to burn these. I'm going to get rid of these. I just want to be normal. And so he gets, and he's headed to the incinerator to burn the stuff in the building. But the elevator lets him off on a floor that he's not familiar with. And he's walking down the hall, and there's a door that's ajar. And he looks in, and there's a TV, and it's playing a movie. And what movie is it? Well, it's The Lost Boys. It's one of his favorite movies. And so he's like, so he kind of wanders in, and he's like, oh, wow. And there's like a little snack on the table, and he takes a bite. And then next thing he knows, he's in this weirdly ornate apartment. Being loomed over by a witch, played by Kristen Ritter, who's very good in this. This is where we learn that it's a magical apartment that lures in children to be dealt with by the witch. You know, if you don't prove useful to said witch, well, that's it for you.
Yikes.
Alex, his only discernible skill is telling scary stories. Well, luckily enough, the witch, Natasha is her name, would very much like to hear some scary stories. And so, as long as he can tell her a scary story every night, he's going to be okay. So, this is when he meets this other girl, this little girl, Yasmin, who basically ushers him into the library. This apartment is very, like, much bigger on the inside kind of thing, because, you know, magical. And this is where he learns that she, this other girl, Yasmin, has sort of made herself useful by being like a sort of housekeeper slash cook slash maintenance person for the, you know, for the witch. You know, she's like, you got to write these stories or, you know, or something bad's going to happen to you. But, you know, he's already decided that he doesn't want to do this stuff anymore. And so he's really conflicted about it. And he's struggling with some writer's block and all that stuff. But in the library, he stumbles across a sort of diary that has been sort of penciled into the margins of some of the many, many books that are in there. And this inspires him. They start to hatch a plan, and they're going to try to escape from the witch. But as often happens with these sorts of magical things, it's much more complicated than that. But yeah, it's like, it's a fun sort of adventure. Like the Hansel and Gretel parallels are pretty obvious, and they're demonstrated quite overtly throughout the film, you know, and more than a little sort of Sherazade kind of Arabian Nights sprinkled in there as well. But it's good. Like, it's got it's nicely paced. There's some really wonderful production elements to it. There's a wonderful touch where whenever he's telling a story, they have their own title card, and they cut to these sort of you know, stilted, more kid-like kind of recreations of the stories, which is a nice sort of interstitial that kind of brings it together. The kids are good. You know, and they're asked to do a lot of heavy lifting, which is always you're always a little leery of that when you're watching a film, but these kids handle it really well. And Kristen Ritter is 100% going for it, like clearly having the time of her life and just gnawing on the scenery at every opportunity. And it's super fun. Look, it's not a great movie, like, but it is sort of reminiscent of the movies that were ostensibly for kids, but maybe a little more adult than maybe we thought about at the time. And that was kind of fun. And
yeah,
I will say the real little ones might be a little bit much for them. But, you know, you got kids, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old. Like, I think they're going to really dig it.
Cool. That sounds good. Might have to check that out. All right. What else have we got this week?
All right. Let's talk about Cop Shop. So it's the latest offering from writer director, sort of grimy, crimey, like auteur Joe Carnahan. And look, I'm not always looking for great cinema. Sometimes you just want to go and enjoy yourself at the movies. And this movie is very much a throwback. It's deliberately evocative of the sorts of B-movie sort of exploitative action cop thrillers that you used to see in like the 70s, like the sorts of movie that when you can't find anything you wanted to watch in Blockbuster, you'd just be like, you pick up a box and be like, all right, I'll give this a go. Like it's evocative of those sorts of movies, but it's super fun. Like right from the beginning, like it's one of those movies where you're just like, okay, this is what we're doing. And this movie doesn't waste any time because we drop in. The events of this film take place in Gun Creek County, Nevada, which it's like you
yeah, so we're subtle.
Yeah, you see that and you're like, oh, okay, well, here we go. There's a bullet-riddled Crown Vic like careening through traffic and then, you know, pulls over to the side and some guy gets out of it and starts running. Meanwhile, we've got a couple of small town like county sheriffs. They're called to break up a fight at a casino, and so they go and they're gonna try to break up this fight. And then out of nowhere, the guy from the bullet riddled car comes flying through, sucker punches one of the cops, and is just like, "Oh, you gotta take me in, I guess." So they take him in, and this is a guy named Teddy, played by Frank Grillo, and he's brought in. And, you know, it gets fingerprinted and they're like, oh, okay, you know, you're going to get X, Y, and Z. We're going to put you in the cells, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all very mysterious as to why he's done all this. State troopers are investigating. They find the car and they're investigating. Drunk driver comes in and slams into the cruiser. drunk guy gets out, starts staggering around, throwing up everywhere, whatever. And the cops are like, they're shaken up but safe. They pick him up and they're like, we got to bring this guy in. And the closest station, wouldn't you know it, is the Gun Creek County Sheriff's Office. Mm. So they bring him in, this drunk guy, and no ID, but just sloppy, staggering drunk. Smells like a brothel, like just like really just a mess. And this guy is played by Gerard Butler. He gets tossed into a holding cell across the way from our friend Teddy. And then it turns out that that this gentleman is actually hired assassin Bob Vittick, who is who has been hired to take care of Teddy.
Oh.
And so, you know, they start jawing at each other from either side behind bars. The cops are trying to keep them quiet. But then, you know, things start to get out of hand when other folks who also have an interest in Teddy's demise start turning up at the police station. And then chaos, like bullets and fist fights and explosions and all the stuff. And it's like, oh, here's a psychopathic hitman from somewhere else. Oh, here's a dirty cop. Oh, here's this and that. Oh, is Teddy telling the truth about all the things that he's saying to the police officers to get him out? Who knows? And yeah, it kind of goes from there. I'm not going to go too far into the specifics because, I mean, frankly, they don't matter. There's something really fun about a movie that is so unapologetically exactly what it is. Like, this is a movie that it's ridiculous, and it knows it's ridiculous, and it leans into the ridiculousness. You know, Frank Grillo, not a great actor, not a ton of range there, but this kind of scumbag is really kind of you know, right in his wheelhouse. Gerard Butler, who I've taken my share of shots at on these airwaves over the years.
I don't like him. I do not like him.
He's his usual, like, glowery, no, grumbly, doughy self. But it works here. Like, it's fine. Like, he's like, oh, yeah, you do suck. You do suck, Gerard Butler. Show me how much you suck. And that's kind of the dynamic we get. And the two of them, they're clearly at odds. Word on the street is that writer-director Joe Carnahan and Frank Grillo were on one side of the divide, and Gerard Butler was on the other side while they were making this movie. Apparently, there was some internal strife during the making of Cop Shop, which, you know, when you're dealing with a brilliant method performer like Gerard Butler, like, you have to expect that sort of thing, I suppose. You know, artistic temperaments and all
right,
that.
Right.
But yeah, it's like the action is ridiculous and super over the top. There are a couple of really delightful turns. Toby Huss, who is a personal favorite of mine,
like
that guy that I just adore, turns up as a completely unhinged fellow assassin at one point, and really dials it up in a way that you're just like, okay, because again, it's that kind of movie. Like,
sure,
you're not here to watch any real people. Like, that's not what this movie is about. This movie is about ridiculous archetypes and completely implausible and illogical scenarios playing out in a hail of gunfire. You know, they're like, at one point there are like drug cartels involved. You know, it's so much nonsense just packed into this very, very small package. But I got to tell you, Rich, I sat there and I laughed, and it was like, I think they meant to be funny. I think it was intentional. You never know with movies like this, but I think their intent was to sort of derive that kind of joy from just how just completely ludicrous everything was. But yeah, like, look, I'm not going to tell anyone to spend however much money to go to a theater and see Cop Shop unless what I've said so far is intriguing to you. I'd say you could go ahead and give it a pass. But when it turns up on a streaming service or on cable at home, it's worth a couple of hours. You'll have a good time.
All right. And we're talking with Alan Adams, of course, of The Main Edge. And finally, at 91, Clint Eastwood directing another one, and I think surprising people by starring in another movie.
91 years old.
Isn't that crazy?
It's nuts. Well, it's one of those things where, like, in the process of researching the review, I found this little tidbit. So Clint Eastwood is the oldest man to ever win an Oscar for directing. He won that 17 years ago. Like, it's just, it's astonishing to think about how long he's been doing this. Like, he's Rowdy Yates. Like, this dude was on Gunsmoke, Rawhide.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he's been around forever. And he's been doing this same sort of thing, this kind of grappling with, you know, the notion of the passage of time and, you know, the nature of masculinity. Like, and he's a central figure in that discourse in pop culture over the last half century. And so, obviously, he's the guy to grapple with it. There's a lot to like about this movie. It's undermined by some pretty significant issues. The script is not good. Clint, bless his heart, man, he's 91 years old. And
I read something that said, he's playing a former tough guy, but somebody said it looks like a stiff breeze would blow him over.
Yeah, he's been, as they say, ridden hard and put away wet. But that being said, he's still a masterful filmmaker. And you get to see some of that in Cry Macho. The story, it's set in 1979. Eastwood plays a guy named Mike Milo. He's a former rodeo rider who has become sort of a horse trainer working for this rancher, played by Dwight Yoakam, who's also very good. His boss tells him, okay, I need you to do something for me. I need you to go to Mexico, and I need you to get my son away from my ex-wife. And then that's kind of it, and we're sort of off. And he crosses the border, he goes to Mexico City. He winds up tracking down the wife, who is, it's unclear what her deal is, but she lives in this gigantic house and is throwing this lavish party. When he shows up, he kind of crashes the party, gets escorted to her quarters by her security. And then he tells her, I'm here for your son. She's like, I don't know where he is, but he's a delinquent and you're welcome to him. And then she inexplicably tries to seduce him. Well, it's sort of a motif for Clint. All women in Clint Eastwood movies love Clint Eastwood. He rebuffs her advances, which makes her mad. So she's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get you. And so she has him thrown out. And so he has to go track down the kid. He finds the kid at a cockfight. His name's Rafo, and he's training his own fighting cock for the cockfights. It's a rooster. He's called Macho. Hence, there we go. There's the title. The cockfight gets broken up, and then Clint Eastwood finds the kid and says, "Okay, you're coming with me. Your dad wants you to come." There's a little back and forth, and then finally the kid agrees to go with him. But circumstances. There's always circumstances.
Sure.
Their vehicle breaks down. So they have to get their hands on another one. That one gets stolen, and they wind up getting stranded in this small town and kind of taken in by a lovely woman named Marta, who runs the local restaurant. You know, and she gives them a place to sleep and feeds them and all that stuff. And and then Marta, of course, falls in love with Clint Eastwood because
like you do,
because that's what happens, because
he's 91 and so hot.
But as they're in this this town, they meet another fellow who basically tames wild horses to sell to other people. But he's he's struggling because as I've been told, wild horses can't be tamed. But unless you have Clint Eastwood,
right,
who basically is helps the guy, starts training the horses, and in turn sort of mentoring the kid and sort of helping him develop his relationship with horses and whatnot. And, they sort of, they grow to connect, and there's a sort of mentorship relationship developing. But then, the phone call comes, Clint Eastwood's boss is like, you got to bring my kid back. And he finds out that there's maybe a little bit more to it than the guy just wanting his son. But you know, a promise is a promise, you know, and he brings the kid and, you know, and has to decide, do I come clean? Do I just take him? What do I do? And what do I do with this sort of life that is starting to grow here? Because, you know, it's, you know, and when, you know, he's the age where he probably wants to settle down.
or just sit for a while.
and then we go from there. Like, look, it is, there are parts of this movie that are just beautiful. Like, Clint Eastwood has, you know, he has an old school eye when it comes to this. And so a lot of these, especially like the outdoor sequences where it's just like, you know, it's just these wide shots of them in the desert, you know, campfires burning at night, you know, it's Clint Eastwood, the kid and the rooster sitting around the campfire. And it's just like, oh, this is really lovely. You know, there are stretches with no dialogue. Those are easily the best parts of this movie because, again, as I mentioned, the script leaves a lot to be desired, particularly in terms of the dialogue and the aforementioned inexplicable women throwing themselves at this geriatric.
Well, I read something about that. Apparently, this has been in development for like 2 decades, and it made some sense when Clint was in his late 60s.
Yes. Well, it's based on it's funny. It's actually a wild story. Like, it began life as a screenplay, got converted into a novel. Then the novel was converted back to a screenplay, and then it started making the rounds. Mm. A lot of different people were attached to this. At one point, Eastwood was going to direct, but Robert Mitchum was going to star. Like,
wow.
Yeah, so we're talking like a long time ago. but the last iteration before Clint, and this is hilarious, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, and it was good to go. Like, it was greenlit and going. Mm. And then the whole thing with his housekeeper broke.
Oh yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well, yeah, Arnie's gonna take a step back for a little bit. But yeah, it's, look, again, like I said, there's some beautiful stuff here, but the reality is, like, and I love Clint Eastwood. Like, I like, my dad was a huge fan of Westerns, and so I grew up watching like the Sergio Leone stuff.
Yeah.
And like stuff like,
man, you know, can he still got his fastball as an actor or no?
Well, there are moments, but they're sort of surrounded by a, you just can't forget how old he is. Mm. I heard someone refer, there's a scene when the car breaks down, when he gets down to look underneath the car, someone said, and I'm not gonna get it exactly right, but they're like, that was more heart-stopping than any horror movie I've seen. Because it's like, is he going to be able to get up?
Oh, no.
I mean, it's just he's just an old guy. And I mean, right. For 91, he looks fantastic. Like,
sure.
You know, and he could
pass. But he's a little bit frail, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, when he's just sitting still and doing the, you get a little bit of the old smolder and you're like, you know, and he could pass for a dude in his, you know, even his mid 70s. But when he starts moving around, it's just like, oh, yeah, you are old. You are old, Clint Eastwood. And again, like, it's, you know, it carries forward so many of the themes that you know, sort of dot his work going forward, whether it's that sort of deconstruction of the, you know, of the cowboy mythos. Like, he's been in conversation with his own sort of, you know, persona for like 30 years.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, even as far back as something like Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Like, it's like he's been having that conversation, you know, and it gives, and, you know, and he's one of the few people who is equipped to have that conversation. Like, his views on masculinity and his ideas about masculinity really span decades. Like, he came of age as an actor in the 50s.
Right.
You know, which is a very different time, you know, than, you know, 2021, which again is 70 years later. but again, there's a lot to offer, that there's a lot of good here. It's just, it's hard to get past some of the issues with the script. And again, just the moments where you're reminded of just how long he's been doing this. So,
but I'm glad he's still out there doing it.
Me too. And honestly, like, I'm glad I saw it. And, you know, it should be, for the record, like, it's still a pretty good movie. Like, it's not like this is a bad film. It's just like, it just has some basic issues simply due to, you know, to circumstances that are outside, I think, the sort of the qualifiers of the movie itself.
Right. Alan Adams talking movies from the Main Edge. Thanks, Al.
Hey, my pleasure.
See you on Wednesday.
Yes, sir.